Support for Boston Public Radio comes from MBA Builders, partnering with clients to help bring the home they envision to life. Their design-build approach involves your project manager from initial consultation through completion. MBA Builders, building relationships. Build with MBA.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan live at the GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. It's two tales of one shutdown. While the president used the border wall stalemate as an opportunity to serve Clemson State football champs fast food, famed chef Jose Andres has been serving furloughed workers hot meals out of a pop-up relief kitchen. Joining us to talk about this, if school lunches are going to become a cash cow for Big Dairy, and other headlines at the intersection of food policy and food culture, is Corby Cummer. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a BPR contributor. Hello, Corby.
Hello there.
Can I make two food comments before we start?
Sure.
One, I am eating for the first time ever the Marjorie sandwich from the Newsfeed Cafe. Spectacular. And smells good. And secondly, this relates to you, Corby. You got a Story Greenspan a couple of weeks ago. She gave us her cookbook. We talked about it. I made over the weekend one of my favorite meals, shepherd's pie, which I've been making since I was in law school a long time ago. The best shepherd's pie I ever made until this weekend, let's say, was an 8. Hers was like a 48. One of the best things I've ever... You ate it. How great was it?
It was delicious. It was really delicious. The spices, there were whatever the spices were, just made it really special.
It's Will fabulous. You tell us what made it different? So it's usually ground lamb and mashed potatoes.
Well, no, it's ground. The ground lamb is in there, but also there's sausage, there's spinach, there's butternut squash. It is really otherworldly great. So when you talk to her, and I know she's a buddy of yours, next time you talk to her, tell her she really hit a home run in my house.
It's a beautiful cookbook, too. Yeah, I bought a couple for people for Christmas. The pictures are great. It's a really beautiful
cookbook.
Talk
about a plug and a testimonial.
Well,
exactly.
It's great. She was great, and you were great to recommend her. Anyway, let's start with, we just talked about this with Senate President Karen Spilka, the concern about food stamps with the shutdown continuing into its 30-something day. What is going on with food stamps?
What's going on with food stamps is because there's continuing uncertainty over how long they will be funded, most food stamps got all of their benefits last week for the month of February. This is still January. So they're going to have to very carefully budget their whole food stamp allotment for the month of February, and nobody knows about March. You know, they're hoping this is completely a thing of the past and the shutdown. But March remains uncertain. What's also happening is that stores that accept SNAP benefits, which is with an EBT, so it looks like a credit card, it removes stigma, people don't see that you're cutting out stamps from a book the way they used to, the stores may not have requalified to be able to accept the EBT electronic plastic cards, and they can't requalify because of the shutdown. And so not that many so the government is saying not that big a percentage of our SNAP recipients are unable to use their cards, but enough in places that could be food deserts where there's only one store they can use them. The food is tying their hands. And PBS did a story about this, and it quoted a woman in northern Arkansas saying, because of an argument about a wall, I have to look people in the eyes every day and tell them they can't pay for their food and for their children's food.
Oh, my God. Is that heartbreaking?
Yeah.
And by the way, would you say there are 2,500 of those?
2,500 retailers.
So it's tens of thousands of people who were obviously affected. The good news is they get food stamps through the end of February, even with a shutdown. The bad news is they can't use them.
And the heartless response that the reporter got, or someone got, when they called up to ask the government, and the government said, hey, don't, you know, 99% of them, it's fine. You know, so
who cares about the 1%?
Exactly, even though it winds up
otherwise,
being
they never say who cares about the 1%.
Yeah, tens of thousands of people. Doesn't seem to make any difference.
So, Corby, one of the great features, I think we've discussed this before, I don't know when this started, the New York Times, is they have a feature that begins with the oddest intro. It says every time they have one, they said, you know, through the years, we've mostly only covered the death of white men. And so we're trying to atone for our sins. They don't say that part. And we're looking back and doing obituaries of people of note who were not white men. We did one with you a couple of weeks. Oh, the woman who invented the green bean casserole, whatever her name was.
Dorcas Riley.
Okay, but now there's another woman
of all time
that I never heard of. Her name is Isabel Kelly. And speaking of food stamps, without Ms. Kelly, we might not even have what we have through the end of February. Tell us about her.
Well, first of all, there's an extremely important fact about Isabel Kelly, apart from her instrumental role in beginning food stamps, which is she was born in Ellington, Connecticut. I'm fourth generation Ellington, Connecticut.
There you go.
Oh.
So this is what really matters to all of your listeners about Isabel Kelly.
She's a homegirl.
And she went to the University of Connecticut right near Ellington and grew up in Simsbury. What did she do? She got a degree in agricultural economics. She was the first woman at UConn to do this.
That's great.
And then she went into the government in 1940 when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was still president. She began food assistance programs, which began with milk. But then they really took off in 1964 when a pilot program for food stamps and food assistance took off and was signed into federal law, I think in 64 or 65, really by Lyndon Johnson. And she was the one who, after the amendment was passed, expanded food distribution, formed the basis of the food stamp program, and created an administrative bureaucracy that she said was open to people of color and welcoming. Why? Because she said she first fell in love with the legislative process when she heard Adam Clayton Powell, the African-American New York State...
From Harlem, New York City, from
Senator
Harlem.
Or congressman?
He was a
congressman,
member of the House, yeah.
And he was saying, if you're giving milk and free food assistance to public schools, you can't redline. You have to allow the same benefits for African-American neighborhoods in Harlem. And the law got changed. And she said, I fell in love with the legislative process. So as an administrator and an important woman administrator, which was rare, she also made a workplace that was very good and equal, open-handed, equal-handed for minorities. And she was very proud of that. But she died, you know, not with an obit in the time, so now they're making up for it. She died in 1997.
Isn't it Fiji, in all seriousness, isn't it fabulous
yes,
that they do
it's
this?
It's been great. It's been great. You're hearing about all these, mostly women.
It's post
a lot
Me
of
Too.
African-American
yeah.
women.
Oh, it is post-Me? Oh,
yeah, they did
that.
The original Me Too reporting, and as part of that, they started this feature.
There's another day. I mean, obituary writing, I always thought that would be a fun job. Wouldn't you think being an obituary writer?
Oh, a wonderful woman named Marguerite Fox wrote a book about writing obits.
She did.
Yeah, there are great books about writing obits.
So, Corby Cummer, whenever I praise the BSO, which I have learned to love, people tease me on the show, Marjorie and others, I am in love with Andres Nelson's, which I am. I love the guy. But I have a bromance of sorts with another Andres who I don't know, Jose Andres. This guy is otherworldly. Here he is. He's been feeding federal workers for free during the shutdown. Here he is, and then a federal worker who visited his pop-up kitchen. Here they are.
We believe that no person should have to go through the pain of not knowing what to feed the children.
We work tirelessly, and we're caught up in a political game. It's a blessing to have other people to help out.
You know, it almost makes me cry. Most of us heard of Andres, not unlike you, when he got into a tiff with Donald Trump after the Mexico comments at the restaurant he was supposed to open at the Trump Hotel in Washington. We also saw him doing otherworldly things when the federal government was abandoning the people of Puerto Rico. He opened up and fed hundreds of thousands of people in Puerto Rico. And now he's doing this. Where's this all come from in this guy?
It's hard to... Well, first of all, he said very movingly to Tim Carman in the Washington Post, my family would sometimes run out of food at the end of the month when we were living paycheck to paycheck. I know what it's like not to have a paycheck. And more than that, his very successful restaurants in Washington, which we love, Zaitinha, our favorite, OML, and Haleo, have relied on federal workers. They're right near the White House. They're right in the middle of that area. That has been his bread and butter and his staple. So he's giving back. But that's just part of this instance. He's putting his thumb in the eye of the Trump administration for not ending the shutdown. He's rewarding his longtime and loyal clients. But he went into Haiti after the earthquake. That was his first international relief. Then he spearheaded an international effort to supply women with clean cook stoves, which sounds like very little, but going out to get the wood for the coal, which gave them a lot of respiratory diseases, they were often raped because they were known to have to go out and get the wood for the cook stoves. So there's a tremendous amount of good that giving them clean cook stoves does. He spearheaded that international effort. And then he has started World Central Kitchen, which helps people all over Washington and has opened a kind of soup kitchen, free lunch for federal workers. There are many restaurants in Washington, not just his, that give free sandwiches to government workers. So when you're in Washington and you show your government ID, there are, he says he's spent $56,000 on his lunchtime sandwiches alone. But now he's opened a kind of soup kitchen for federal workers.
Yeah, and it's just steps away from the White House.
Yeah.
Maybe the president can see it out the window. I don't know.
You know what also?
He can't. I've been to that test kitchen, and it's very centrally located.
The scale of what this guy does, you know, a lot of us like to think we do an individual event, we feel good about ourselves. I mean, this is, he is affecting the lives of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people through the work he does.
So this next story about surge pricing or serving, charging different amounts of money at different times of day, or like on Super Bowl Sunday when you feel like you won't get many people in the restaurant. I love this idea.
So I think it's a great idea. There's a guy named Nick Kokonis who's wonderfully outspoken, and he's a restaurant owner of Alinea in Chicago. When I say that, it rings dog whistle bells for foodies because it's often considered the best. It has one best restaurant in the country.
Oh, wow.
It's
what's it called again?
Alinea, A-L-I-N-E-A. It's a very avant-garde. Very hard to get into, but he started this online system called Tuck, in which you buy tickets in advance. It's pay or play. You don't show up for the meal. Sorry, you lost your $175. But it might have been $85 because it was Super Bowl Sunday when nobody was going to come to the restaurant. So he not only started the system, which seems unnecessarily penurious for a lot of us who don't want to have to commit ahead of time, but it doesn't strand the restaurant if they don't show up. But it also has variable pricing. So depending on what time people come in. So it's another way of saying the early bird special.
I was just going to say.
Our
it's not
favorite.
Right, of
so
course.
It's not new. But if the restaurant has the staff and the cooks at 5 p.m., why don't they just charge less for the meals from 5 to 7 p.m.? Or after 10 p.m. So that's what they're doing, variable pricing. Resy, one of the online services, R-E-S-Y, started to try to pay extra to get reservations between 7 and 9. So it was like premium tickets at sports games or in the theater for hot shows. That failed. People really resented it. So in this system, variable pricing, there is one set of menu prices. They don't exceed it. So it's this psychological barrier. You're not paying more than usual, but you can get a deal.
You know what this is like? This is like the congestion pricing debate with the governor. He does not want you to pay more if you come in at rush hour, but he says he'd be open to you paying less. He's worried about slippery slope. If you came in a non-rush hour, you know, forget the Alinea. Is that how you say the name of the restaurant?
You said it perfectly.
The average restaurant. I mean, almost everything that I eat dinner at when I walk by or drive by during the day has only a bunch of people. I don't understand why there's not a stampede to be doing this kind of thing. I mean, it's sort of. The other example is Restaurant Week. I assume. I mean, most people say they may. Well, I don't know. Is Restaurant Week a success? It's a loss leader for a lot of
restaurants. It depends on who you ask. It depends. What they want to know is, will the people come back?
Come back. So, there's no downside to this. You have fixed costs. You're there. The only additional thing is, I assume, some places close at non-rush hours so they don't have to pay their staff. But short of that, you got to pay for the heat. You got to pay for the whatever. So this is a win-win for a restaurant, isn't
it? I agree that it's a win-win. What I'm interested in, there's a very good piece on New York Magazine's website, Grub Street. And it quoted a lot of different software system developers. But what it didn't say was that sometimes you could just walk into a restaurant and it would run through a printer lower price menus that said was good from 5 to 7. It acted as if the only way of doing this was through online software. I'm sure that's the only way for softline entrepreneurs to make money. But I wonder if it's an idea that restaurants would adopt. We're just going to put early bird special and have a lower priced menu.
Well, it's like happy hour, too. They're a million. I mean, no, we don't have that. We don't allow that for drinks, I guess, in Massachusetts.
I don't think so. But get rid of it.
I think it's a great idea. I am embracing it.
Although some places that are really popular that I've tried to get into, like at 5 o'clock, you can't even get into it at 5
o'clock.
Well,
then they don't have it.
They're the exception.
Yeah, I guess they are the exception.
So okay, we're talking to Corby Comer, our food guy.
So what is this deal with the Land O'Lakes and milk and cheese overwhelming American school lunches because of Well, I don't know why.
Well, the deal is there's shocking overproduction of milk. And when I say shocking, if family farms and large farms have a certain herd of cattle, those cows are going to produce the same amount of milk every day for the entire year. No Christmas off, no Martin Luther King Day. It's every day. It's the same production. Where are they going to sell that milk if they have capacity? Milk consumption is going way down in this country, especially so-called fluid milk, the kind you drink. People don't drink milk anymore.
Why?
Because it's gone out of fashion, because there's lactose intolerance. Because
they're going to different, the oat milks and the almond milks and all that, is that why?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a tremendous amount of lactose intolerance. Studies don't really support the idea that it's important for calcium.
And environmental stuff,
bones,
too,
you
right?
can get calcium from other sources. So the milk industry is going crazy, and the main route for years has been school lunches and school nutrition programs. 7.6 of one estimate of the U.S. dairy businesses' sales are to these feeding programs, chiefly schools.
7.6 what?
Percent of annual sales of milk.
I see.
So this is a very important market for them. So they want to encourage students to have milk. And one of the great bones of contention with the Obama administration's Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, which went into effect in 2008, I think, was that it required that chocolate milk be skimmed. Now, the real problem with chocolate milk is not the fat. Fat is now back into fashion. My dean, Darius Mozafarian at Tufts Friedman, thinks it's great to have as much milk fat as you like. The problem is sugar. And so flavored milk is where kids will drink milk. And I think they would drink a lot more of it if it had a full fat quotient in it. But milk consumption has just gone down since Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act went in.
So what is Purdue? Sonny Perdue is the Secretary of Agriculture. Why? What is he exactly getting criticized for?
He's getting criticized for a bunch of rollbacks in the Obama administration's school nutrition rules. And you know what he's being...
But how does milk fit? I mean, milk is...
He says chocolate milk is what made me big as I am. I
and
love chocolate milk. It's just ridiculous. It's un-American to restrict chocolate milk. He's turned it into a culture war. The real... And there's a very long article about the dairy industry trying to get back its foothold in the market by, again, being able to have flavored milk, chocolate milk, strawberry milk with lots of sugar in them. The ideal would be if they could flavor the milk with less sugar in it, full fat should be fine again, or 1% to 2%. But let me just say the real problem with Sonny Perdue is rolling back sodium. Sodium leads to chronic illnesses, and it's so easy to wean students off a taste for sodium and salt. That's where they should draw the line, and they're not.
You know, speaking of salt, I know it's on our agenda today, but when you mention it, Bloomberg attempted as mayor. We know his soda thing failed. I guess the Supreme Court in New York State knocked it out. Didn't he attempt to do a salt thing? And didn't San Francisco attempt to do a salt thing too? Is there any city that has either a warning on a menu, or was that just proposed and never went?
No,
anywhere?
I think there still is the warning on the New York City menu that is like a red salt shaker if it's over 2,300 milligrams of sodium a day. Like in one portion of a Cheesecake Factory entree. It wasn't Cheesecake Factory. It was the worst offender. But what he tried to do was get much more sodium restrictions inside of meals and calorie restriction in restaurants in New York, and it didn't work. But something that Tom Friedman, the health commissioner of New York, with Mayor Bloomberg did was create something, the National Voluntary Salt Reduction Initiative. That did make headway. How did it do it? The way England did it, which was by getting industry together to, in secret, not publicizing it, not particularly secret, in lockstep, slowly reduce the amount of sodium in food, which is the only way you cannot make companies lose money.
So, Corby, we only have a minute or two left here. Whole Foods, we talked to you a year or so ago when they initiated this, the 365 stores. That was the future, smaller scale. I love the idea. Now they are freezing. I think there are 12 of them. They're not building anymore. They're saying they're letting the 12 stay. And John Mackey, who is still the CEO, even though Amazon has bought it, is saying, I don't know, this is not a step back for us. This is because under Amazon, I'm paraphrasing, our regular stores are de facto bargain kinds of stores like 365 were intended to be. I assume there's more to the story. Is there more to the story or no?
I assume there is. I think that it's that Amazon has decided its brand name and brand promotion is going to be the Whole Foods name. Don't confuse the marketplace with this 365. Okay. Its own private label that it pushes on Amazon will say Whole Foods. It will claim that the prices are going to be as low as 365 prices were, and they might be. We haven't tracked the prices, but what they're deciding is we don't need this other brand. It's confusing. We're going to say that we stand for value anyway, and Whole Foods is the name we're now promoting under Amazon.
Fair enough. Nice to see you, Corby.
Okay, Corby Kammer, thank you very much, as always. Corby Kammer joins us every week. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a BPR contributor. Up next, a new Frontline NPR investigation looks at American coal miners who are dying of this new, more virulent black lung disease, a disease that could have been prevented. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.